been a lot on Biz News recently about what Donald Trump intends with South Africa. With the best will in the world, we aren't as close to the action as the man we're going to be talking to in a moment, Joel Pollack. He's a senior editor at Breitbart. He's the man who has been tipped widely to be the next U.S. ambassador in South Africa. And he knows the country. He's married to Rhoda Kadali's daughter, Julia. We are going to find out from him what we should be expecting from the new Trump administration. Joel, really good to be talking with you. I watched the fascinating podcast that you did with the Jewish Report, and it does appear as though South Africa's in for a pretty tough time. But I love the piece that you wrote yesterday, and I think perhaps we can start there. You gave some free advice to South Africa on how to deal with Donald Trump. Before we go into that, how well do you know the guy?
Well, in a sense, I know him very well. And in another sense, I don't know him at all. I mean, I've followed his entry into politics very closely. I've written several books about his presidency, about his policies, about his campaigns. So from that point of view, I know him very well. But on a personal level, I don't know him that well at all. And I'm a big fan politically, but I don't hang around Mar-a-Lago and so forth. You know, I'm not socially in the mix. I just do my thing out here in California, focus on my job, my family, and the bigger debate.
And Breitbart, which you've been involved in pretty much from the beginning, I'm not sure everybody understands that. And you also act as the in-house legal counsel, having done your law degree at Harvard Law School. So very useful to have someone like you on the staff. What got you into contributing editorially, or has that always been your first love?
It's a great question. So when I joined Breitbart 14 years ago, I joined as legal counsel because the company was growing. It was then in its early phase. It was a website with multiple different pages, big government, big Hollywood, big journalism, and big peace. These were each focused on a different aspect of policy or culture. And I was there to help build the defenses of the company against lawsuits, because there was a deliberate strategy by the left, funded by George Soros and other donors, to take out conservative media outlets by litigating, by suing, causing great legal expenses and so forth. So I was initially part of the effort to protect the company against that, and I did that for a while. And then we switched from being a blog format to being a 24-hour a day, 7 days a week news service. And that's when Andrew Breitbart elevated me basically to editor-in-chief. He wanted a lawyer in the role because, even though it's primarily in an editorial role, again, there was this persistent threat from left-wing organizations to try to interfere with the company's growth. And this has been part of a fight that's gone on for a decade and a half, really trying to protect freedom of speech against these sorts of assaults. Even when they come from the private sector, they violate the spirit of free discourse and free debate. But I served in that role for 2 years, and then the company shifted its focus. We really started out in California, actually. We started out covering Hollywood because Andrew Breitbart, founder of the company, was very focused on how culture influences politics. He believed that, as he said, politics is downstream from culture, that culture really determines everything. And so he wanted to be out here in Los Angeles covering the politics of Hollywood. And we've had a really tremendous impact on that. Our coverage really has changed the way I think Hollywood influences, rather now doesn't influence, political debate. It still has significant influence, but it really now has been tempered, I think, by a growing awareness among the public that certain cultural figures and cultural messages are really attempts at manipulating public opinion, and people are now wise to it. So I stepped back from the editor-in-chief role as the company's nexus really moved to Washington, D.C., and I stayed here in California. And in my role as senior editor, I undertook various different projects. I still write about California, about national politics, about foreign policy, and I've been doing that for 14 years. I also have a radio show here on Sunday night, and I still write a lot of books. My latest book is called The Agenda, What Trump Should Do in His First 100 Days. And I'm very pleased that he seems to be following most of the suggestions. There are a few that he has done that I did not anticipate. I didn't anticipate taking over Gaza, for example, which is rather interesting. But then, of course, the circumstances have changed on the ground so much. And it's a fascinating place to be. California is a very rich state. It's the fifth largest economy in the world, if it were to be a country on its own. But it runs very much like a third world country with a one-party state because the voters here are staunchly Democratic. Less so, perhaps, as they've seen the results of some of these policies, but we are essentially governed by one party, and it has some of the consequences with which you may be familiar. Corruption, mismanagement, and I'm dealing with the fallout from the Palisades fire, which affected my community. My house survived, but my neighborhood is burned down completely. And although it was a natural disaster, the damage was greatly exacerbated by government incompetence. So we're dealing with that right now.
It's an interesting background. You also have a very close relationship with South Africa, having been born in Johannesburg. And as is well known here, worked with Tony Leon, writing speeches for him. And your connection here, again, as I mentioned in the intro, your wife is Rhoda Kodaly, who's a hero and an icon in the country. So you're very...
My
very
wife is Rhoda Kodaly's daughter, not Rhoda Kodaly herself.
Yeah, but, and you wrote the biography. But why is Donald Trump, why is he so interested in South Africa?
Well, I think it's for a number of reasons. First of all, I think that Trump is interested in making America stronger and more economically powerful. And he sees the challenge that China is posing to American interests on the African continent and specifically in South Africa. That's a challenge both economic and military. The America First philosophy that Trump uses doesn't mean a complete withdrawal or isolationism. It does, however, mean that America's economic interests must be at the top for Trump. And he has had an interest in South Africa mostly for that reason. Also, keeping in mind that there are many American companies that have investments in South Africa or that would like to invest in South Africa, but cannot do so or feel vulnerable if they're exposed to some of the political risk in South Africa. So I think he's taken an interest from that point of view. In the last few years, South Africa has also really been aggressively attacking American allies and American interests on the world stage. I mentioned China, the essential expulsion of the Taiwanese embassy from Pretoria was something many Republicans noticed. The cozy relationship with Russia during the invasion of Ukraine. And of course, the ICJ case against Israel, where South Africa essentially defended Palestinian terrorism. That caught the attention of people in Trump's circle and certainly Americans in general. Democrats actually wrote in 2023 to President Biden at the time asking him to punish South Africa for helping Vladimir Putin. Democrats, of course, had put Russia at the top of their agenda in the same way that China is at the top of Trump's agenda. So there's been a steady loss of patience with South Africa's foreign policy positions. And I think you take those things together with some of the economic uncertainty around the Expropriation Act, I think it led to Trump taking a very public position against South Africa's foreign and domestic policies.
Franz Grenier, who comments fairly regularly on our program, was talking to us recently about the relevance of Simonstown. Perhaps you could elaborate a little bit there, given that South Africa is only a tenth of the size in economic terms of California. It's a little bit like, from a GDP perspective, it's a little bit like Swaziland as against South Africa, just for local people that they can understand. We're very small in America's life in an economic perspective, but in a geopolitical perspective, Simonstown, certainly from what France says, seems to be a very important piece on the chessboard.
Yeah, let me talk about Simonstown for a moment. And it's actually an opportunity to fill in some of the answers to a question you asked earlier. So I was born in Johannesburg. My parents moved to the Chicago area when I was 8 weeks old. So I grew up in Chicago or the Chicago suburbs, and I studied at Harvard University. And then I came back to South Africa on a Rotary Foundation ambassadorial scholarship. And I intended on staying a year or 18 months. And I became completely fascinated by South Africa's political transition. So I worked as a journalist for a couple of years. Then I was hired, as you mentioned, by Tony Leon as a speechwriter. That's where I met Julia in Parliament. She was an intern for the Democratic Alliance. We met there, and she has continued her work on economic policy, which is what she was doing in Parliament. And she's now one of the foremost labor economists in the United States. Simonstown is important to me, not only because it's scenic and beautiful, and it was a place I enjoyed visiting a lot when I lived in Cape Town, but actually my father served at the Simonstown Naval Base when he was doing his military service in the mid-1970s, and my mother apparently lived in an apartment nearby. So Simonstown has some relevance for my family, so I know it well. And the reason it's important strategically is for the same reason that South Africa's really been important for half a millennium, which is that it is situated near the confluence of the Atlantic and Indian Oceans. And particularly as the Indo-Pacific becomes a chessboard in international relations, very important for trade, very important for military affairs, Simonstown has achieved an elevated importance. And of course, it's been, despite its small size and its tranquil nature, it's been a point that's been fought over or strategically important to empires for centuries, whether it's Napoleon or the British and so forth. And it remains important. Even though it's a small port, it can be expanded. And it is an important naval station in this entire game of the Indo-Pacific. So there is a tremendous amount of interest in what China might do if it gains influence on the African continent, and what it could do to South Africa, not just to the United States. But, you know, the pattern in Chinese relations on the African continent is that China will lend money to African countries and then come to collect on the terms of that debt, which are often very unfavorable to the borrowing nation. And it will seize key assets, usually ports, airports, mines, infrastructure, that sort of thing. So there's a real concern that South Africa's closeness to China could lead to China either taking over key strategic assets that are important to South Africa's economy, or taking over military installations that are important to maintaining peace around the world, which is fundamentally what the United States wants to do. The United States' global mission really is to keep things calm so that the global economy can grow, keep the lanes of trade open for free commerce. And China isn't necessarily interested in the same thing. China wants to control its sphere of influence, whether it's in the Western Pacific or now increasingly the Indian Ocean. And Simonstown is a key point in that endeavor.
And Donald Trump's next move, as it were, in South Africa, we have seen here that it's very adversarial at the moment between the South African government and the U.S. government. We understand, you've reported that there are three missions that are ready to go to the U.S., but you've also reported that it's unlikely anybody's going to see them when they get there, whether it's Cyril or the DA or Solidarity.
Yes, and since that article, people have reached out, they want to meet me, but I can't conduct diplomacy for the United States. I'm a private citizen, I'm a journalist, so you know we're not allowed to do that. But the reality is that the people that South Africa needs to meet are not yet in their positions because the administration is very young and there's been a change in policy, as you've mentioned. So they can meet with the people who are literally sitting at the desks in the State Department occupying the foreign policy positions that would normally deal with South Africa. But those people represent either the permanent civil service or they are holdovers from the previous administration. The new administration's nominees are not yet in their posts. So there's nobody really to talk to. And if you try to talk to some of the candidates for those positions, some of the undersecretary positions, deputy secretary positions, which sound junior but are actually very senior, if you try to talk to them, they won't talk to anyone because the Senate, so I'm told, does not look favorably on candidates for some of these positions if they start behaving as if they already have the roles before they've been confirmed. So it's going to be very difficult for South Africa to meet with the diplomatic staff. And as for the president and the secretary of state, I don't think they're going to have anything to do with South Africa right now, given the policy differences and, I'm sorry to say, the way in which South Africa's leadership has responded. You know, it's not good to accuse President Trump of misinformation that phrase is extremely loaded in an American context. You know, you may quibble with one or two of his facts, and I've done that before, certainly in some of my editorial pieces and news coverage and so forth. But the left in this country tried to shut down news outlets like mine, and they tried to censor the president. They did, in fact, censor him by accusing him of spreading misinformation. The first time Donald Trump was ever censored by a social media company was when he did a press event with some doctors who were questioning some of the COVID restrictions and COVID masks and so forth. Those doctors turned out to be right, but at the time, that was against the medical orthodoxy and the political program of the Democratic Party, and so they convinced Facebook and Twitter at the time to shut down the live stream and to censor those posts from Donald Trump, and by the way, from Breitbart, because we had a camera there. And that's the censorship that is associated with the phrase misinformation. There really is an attempt by the president's enemies to control him and the flow of information in this country by accusing him of misinformation. So when that word is used, for Americans at least, it triggers an association with the past 5 years, really, of attempts to crush free speech online and elsewhere. Those are all being reversed now that Trump has been elected. They are a big part of why he was elected, because Americans stood up against it. But it was a big mistake for Cyril Ramaphosa to accuse the president of misinformation. And some of the other commentary hasn't been helpful. I don't think that this is a problem that can simply be smoothed over by going and trying to explain things the way the South African government sees them. The United States is well aware of how the South African government sees things, but I don't think the South African government has heard how the United States sees things in quite some time. And part of the problem has been that South Africa hears a lot of flattering commentary about 1994, which was a miraculous political development. But as one British commentator said, you can't really run on the fumes of 1994 for that long. People are concerned about the direction of the country. They're concerned about their investments in the country or their potential investments. They're concerned about China. They're concerned about South Africa's support for terrorism. And it really worries people. And it's refreshing, I think, to hear Donald Trump say what many Americans are thinking. And so some of the rhetoric coming back from South Africa has really been unhelpful. I also saw that President Thabo Mbeki said he was baffled by the change overnight in the Republican Party. It's not just a change in the Republican Party. Again, the Democrats wrote to President Joe Biden back in 2023. It was a bipartisan letter, but it was signed by Senate Democrats who are normally very friendly to Africa, and they are very, very concerned about the direction that South Africa is heading. So this is now a bipartisan issue. And if South Africa didn't get the message then when President Biden was in office, they are certainly getting it now.
So clearly they are misreading President Trump. Have you got some recommendations that you can pull from the piece that you wrote yesterday that should be read or at least absorbed by the ANC?
Well, I like to look ahead to the end of something like this. You know, I think in any endeavor, any challenging situation, you want to try to look ahead to what the end of it feels like. And if you can imagine where this ends up, the future that I like to imagine is some kind of agreement on the White House lawn, let's say, some kind of bilateral treaty between South Africa and the United States, setting aside AGOA and all of that, which is a very serious issue. We can discuss that if you want. But I sort of tried to imagine what it would look like if all these issues were resolved. And most of them involved South Africa changing its foreign policy, changing its BEE laws, dropping some of the labor laws that make it almost impossible for people in South Africa, never mind foreign companies, impossible to run a business, and liberalizing the South African economy while also making clear that it's going to protect private property rights, repealing the Expropriation Act and finding a more sensible way of dealing with the problem of eminent domain, which we have here in this country as well. I think South Africa has to make those changes. And if it does make those changes, I think there are some reciprocal movements that the United States can make. One of the things I've suggested, for example, is that the U.S. could support a South African Olympic bid to be the first Olympics held in Africa. I see that Egypt has taken an interest in hosting the Olympics. There's no reason that Egypt should be the first African nation to host the Olympics. And there could be a significant investment from the United States in that. There could be investments in power generating capacity. There could be investments in solar energy and green technology and all sorts of things. And these investments can really change the lives of South Africans for the better. They can take advantage of certain natural advantages as well as the incredible skill and drive of the South African people. So I think there will be benefits flowing back in the other direction, but there have to be commitments by South Africa to make these fundamental changes. And then I think it's possible to imagine an incredible relationship. You could see Donald Trump, who's, I think, somewhat misunderstood and reviled, I think, in the South African media. You could see him becoming kind of a hero, because I think he can reset not just the relationship, but he can reset South Africa back onto a path of prosperity and unity.
Jobs, jobs, jobs are the three biggest words in this country, as you well know, with the high unemployment rate. But what about the transactional president? We hear so much that Donald Trump is a businessman who happens to have gone into politics. He doesn't really care about, well, he can't have another term. How is he best handled transaction-wise? Or perhaps you could just give,
well,
again,
first you have to show that you're willing to give him something of what he wants. The endless rhetoric, the attacks, we've heard it all. I mean, I saw a cartoon in the South African media by Shapiro portraying Trump as Hitler, which is about the oldest insult that's been thrown at him. I mean, we're so used to it already. It's offensive, but it doesn't help. And I think that South Africans need to hear what he's saying and take a few steps toward him. I think I would look at this Expropriation Act as a first step, because that seems to be the focus of his executive order. And I would see if it can be repealed or amended. And then I think there's a conversation that begins.
And what about this view that South Africans supporting Trump are all white and that those opposing him are all black? And as a consequence, he's becoming a divisive figure in the country.
Well, I don't know about that. I mean, I haven't seen any polling data in South Africa, but the remarkable thing about Trump is that he has won a higher share of the black vote and the Hispanic vote in this country than any other Republican president going back decades and decades and decades. And he did that while running against racial preferences. You know, it turns out that many people simply don't want to be thought of as different or requiring special treatment or special concessions. People just want to show up and work, succeed, build their dreams. And that's why Donald Trump actually even won a majority of the male vote in the Hispanic electorate. I mean, so black Americans increasingly like Donald Trump. Hispanic Americans like Donald Trump. A lot of people are gravitating toward Donald Trump. So I would actually be surprised if white South Africans and black South Africans felt differently. In fact, some of the many insulting things I think that I've seen in the South African media were written by white people. Not that I view them that way or that we should, but you know, now that you bring up the issue, I sort of think about that. And I just don't think it matters. Donald Trump does not care about that. And I don't think at the core, South Africans care about it. I mean, we care about our identities as human beings, right? Everybody cares about it. Americans do, South Africans do. But we also transcend them. And in certain modes, especially economically, we often forget about them. You know, when we're working together, cooperating together, it just doesn't matter. So I think that there may be some truth to what you're saying. I don't know. But that's not an immutable truth. It certainly hasn't been in American politics, where Trump is increasingly appealing to voters among racial minorities who in this country are black, Hispanic, Asian, and other.
It is Valentine's Day. How does South Africa show some love to the new U.S. administration? And what kind of love could come back in return?
Make love great again. You know, that's my favorite way of putting it. Look, I think South Africa should drop the case against Israel at the International Court of Justice. It doesn't cost South Africa anything to do it. South Africa is not going to win the case. The new presiding judge at the International Court of Justice is from Uganda. She's probably the most pro-Israel judge on the court, aside from the judge from the United States. And she actually wrote a quite brilliant dissent in one of the previous opinions. I think that would be a gesture that would go a long way. It would show that South Africa understands that that case has been a red flag for much of the West, even though there are many Western governments that have been critical of Israel for many reasons and critical of the war and so forth. I think that arguing that there's some kind of right to commit acts of murder against innocent people, which is what Hamas does, and that's what South Africa did argue, by the way. It didn't just argue that Israel was doing bad things. It actually argued that Palestinians have a right to use murder because of some so-called right to resist, which doesn't actually exist in international law. It's kind of made up. But really, to go and argue that there's some cause for which murder is acceptable is shocking. And it actually is corrosive, I think, to South Africa internally, because how does the same government then come back home from The Hague and try to stop crime at home? It's really just a terrible signal. I would drop that first as a gesture of goodwill and then see if you can work out the other issues.
And the love that could come back from America when you talk about investment into infrastructure, billions of dollars, would that be through aid, which has now been cut off?
No, it would be investment that expects a return. But I think there are so many centers of excellence in South Africa, even in incredibly difficult circumstances, that I don't think it would be difficult for American investors to identify places in which to invest where there'd be an expectation of success. And not just success for American investors, but as you mentioned earlier, jobs for South Africans. There are ideal conditions right now, for example, for some of the new technologies that are being used in green energy in the United States to come into South Africa. The Northern Cape is ideal for solar energy. The Western Cape has hydroelectric. There are all kinds of new nuclear technologies coming online that the United States can build in South Africa. And look, there are also ways of tapping into South Africa's traditional fossil fuel resources. And coal can be brought online. I know it's been very tough in South Africa with some of the coal generating plants going offline, even the new ones. But there are places for American investment that can really build South Africa's infrastructure and restore it to where it ought to have been by this point. And look, I'll mention the Olympics again, just because it's a focal point. You know, people debate whether the Olympics are good or bad for a country, but it's really just how you approach them. And if you think about it as just a big sporting event, maybe it is a waste of money and you can end up saddled with debt. But if you think about it as a way of motivating a country to move its infrastructure forward, to improve its public safety, to make sure that its residents are employed, I think it can be a way of motivating South Africans and Americans to work together. So I think there are so many different ways that investment can take place. And South Africa does have a lot to offer, but people aren't going to come into the country and invest if, for example, under BEE regulations, they have to hand over 30% of their company or whatever it is. It's just not going to happen. People may sympathize with South Africa's desire to redress the injustice of the past, but they're not going to subsidize it. And I think South Africa has to make some very fundamental changes before progress can be made.
Thanks for mentioning fossil fuels, because we have magnificent reserves all along the coast, right from the west through to the south. Just to close off with, it seems to me that treat Trump differently and there's a big opportunity.
Treat Trump differently and also think about South Africa differently. Think about the immense potential of the South African people. You know, his executive order focused on Afrikaners, on farmers, and that drew a lot of attention. But what was really interesting about that was that Donald Trump had identified something very important, which is that South Africa's greatest asset is not its mineral wealth, but actually its people. And I think that if the South African government can remember that, as well as be a little bit nicer to Donald Trump, I think it will go a long way.
Joel Pollack is senior editor at Breitbart. I'm Alec Hogg from BizNews.com.